Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sassano. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ETHub Weekly Recap. On these episodes, we discuss the ETHub Weekly Newsletter, which covers the latest news from the Ethereum ecosystem and crypto space as a whole. This week, we'll be discussing the news from February 18th to February 24th. Hey, Anthony, you want to walk us through the news?
Hey, Eric, sure. So before I jump into the news, I just wanted to talk about a couple of things. So Constantinople is going live on Feb 28th. Well, we hope it's going live on Feb 28th, third time's a charm. So if you haven't updated your Ethereum nodes, please do so. It's going live at block, I think, 7.2 million or around about that from memory. So definitely update your nodes before then, and hopefully it goes through this time. And I also mentioned in the newsletter that we have a few upgrades planned for ETHub in March. When we're both back on deck, we've both been pretty busy lately, but we've got a few things coming in March, so definitely keep an eye out for that. We'll update you in the newsletter. And Eric, did you want to talk a little bit about the Gitcoin matching you've been doing this week?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think a decent amount of people are probably definitely aware of Gitcoin, and I'm pretty sure aware of Gitcoin Grants. But if you're not, Gitcoin Grants is basically, in a nutshell, a way for people to give to open source projects that are being built on Ethereum. For example, ETHub's on there. We've got a lot of generous donations for our, you know, for our fund on there. And over the first 2 weeks of February, Gitcoin ran what they called a CLR matching initiative, which basically, you know, they were matching donations to funds. It did really well. I believe it was up to $25,000, and even ETHub got a lot of nice match from them, which was great to see. I randomly the other day put out a tweet that said I would match new funds to grants between 10 and 100 DAI up to 1,000 DAI. And it's been a pretty awesome response from the community. We're actually up to 6,000 DAI committed to matching at this point. So, you know, I suggest everybody go out there, check out Gitcoin Grants. There's a lot of awesome projects out there to fund. And just, you know, right now the multiplier on matching is 6 times. So basically, if you were to give a 50 DAI donation to a project, you're going to get matched 300 DAI on top of that. We're calling it the Gitcoin Torch. You get a pretty cool little badge on Gitcoin that Kevin created, the founder of Gitcoin, if you become a matcher of this. So it's pretty cool initiative, kind of, to be honest, picked up more than I thought it would. And we also have a page up on ETHub kind of explaining what it is. So definitely suggest people go and check that out.
Yeah, it's been awesome to follow this on Twitter and see what all the work that you've been doing with this, Eric. It's really cool to see people get more involved in funding different teams. We've been a big proponent of funding of these open source teams because we kind of believe there's a tragedy of the commons problem where the funds aren't distributed to the correct teams. So it's really great to see more people getting involved with this. So if you haven't checked it out yet, go to Gitcoin Grants. Just Google it and it'll come up. There are tons of teams on there. There are ETH 2.0 teams. There's us, ETHub, of course. There's various teams building various things, like Austin Griffith. Griffith has one up there for the burner wallet. There's a lot more on there. I've actually seen it grow a lot over the past few weeks. A lot more teams are getting on board because they're seeing that they can actually get some funding out of it, which is really good to see. It's good to see the community give back, because obviously a lot of people in the community from the earlier times, especially from the ICO, if they've held their ETH till now, it's appreciated over 100 times, you know. So it's good to see them give back those profits back into a community that gave so much to them. Cool. So now I wanted to move on to the news. It's just one big news item this week, which I thought was really cool to see. So the Galaxy S10 was the Samsung Galaxy S10 was announced this week, and along with the announcement, they launched a product called private key storage product in the S10. So basically, it's a crypto wallet. I think I saw Bitcoin and ETH on there. I think it's going to support other crypto as well. But this is huge. Like a crypto wallet being natively installed on a mainstream smartphone, like, we haven't seen this before. I know we've seen HTC attempt this with I think it was one of their HTC phones, a blockchain phone or something. And I think it was a ICO for one in 2017 that turned out to be quite shady, I think. I can't remember exactly. But this is definitely mainstream adoption, if I've ever seen any. A lot of people made comments about this. Some of them were saying that, oh, it's not that big of a deal because we still need to educate users. And of course we do. And I actually think I saw on Twitter a video of, I can't confirm if it's real or fake, but there was a video of the device actually going through a tutorial on how to use the wallet, a nice little video tutorial for people to follow. So I'm not sure if that was real or not, but if it is real, that's exactly what we need. We'll have the education there for when people load up the wallet, and they'll be able to onboard onto crypto, buy, you know, some BTC or ETH and explore what crypto has to offer. So it's definitely laying the foundation for more mainstream adoption. So what did you think of this one, Eric?
Yeah, this is really neat. I mean, this was rumored for a little while. Some screenshots leaked, I think, a couple weeks back. But of course, I mean, we talked about it as well on the podcast, but you never really know what's real and what's not at this point in crypto land. So it was neat to see it confirmed. I kind of wasted 2 hours of my life watching the S10 announcement to see if they were going to talk about it in the keynote. They actually didn't. But then after they kind of, you know, had their website up and some press releases and it was mentioned in there. I mean, I'm extremely bullish on this idea for a multitude of reasons. I mean, first, the most obvious is that you're putting crypto wallets in the hands of millions upon millions of people all across the world. Nothing bad can come of that. No matter what, even if 1% of the people that have S10s adopted, that's a big growth for the crypto space, which is still kind of new and nascent. On top of that, there's a lot of really cool secure hardware coming out on phones, right? Like the Touch ID and Face ID on iPhones have its own secure enclave. I haven't really looked into the hardware aspect of the Samsung wallet, but it sounds like it's kind of secure off on its own on the phone, and they're using their Samsung Knox technology to kind of keep the private key secure. So of course, you know, Ledger is kind of the go-to in hardware wallet space right now, and they released their new one a few weeks back, which can talk to Bluetooth and talk to phones, so it makes it kind of easier to transport and have your crypto hot wallet on the go. But, you know, of course, if this is now built into phones natively, and it already is now on the Samsung side, and I'm sure someday Apple's going to match this on the iPhone side. I mean, the user experience of that is well beyond, you know, having to carry around a hardware wallet and hook it up to Bluetooth on your phone to use.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting you mentioned the Ledger device. This definitely is a competitor for that device, I think. But at the same time, I think the Ledger device, it depends which one you buy. If you buy the classic one that isn't Bluetooth, you obviously aren't going to carry that around with you. You're going to keep it somewhere at home, maybe in a safe or maybe off-site, not even at home if you're extra paranoid or have better operational security. But this is definitely good for, I wouldn't store any large amounts of crypto on the S10 wallet, simply because I always carry my phone around with me, of course. And any of the mobile wallets that I currently use on my iPhone, I don't actually store much on there. Obviously for security reasons, if I lose my phone, then I'm going to lose my crypto. Yeah, you can have backups and things like that, like your seed phrase, but you've got to make sure that they're backed up offline and everything. It's just a bit of a mess. I prefer to keep my crypto in cold storage, definitely not anywhere where, you know, I can lose it easily or things like that. I know where it is at all times. It'd be interesting to see how people end up using these wallets. I know that people already store a lot of crypto on exchanges, but I think exchanges are a little bit different to this. So if you were to lose your phone, of course, you don't have your backup keys, you're going to lose your crypto altogether. Whereas on an exchange, even if you get hacked, like reputable exchanges like Coinbase have you insured for up to $250,000, I think, for certain accounts from memory. Not that you should store your crypto on an exchange, of course, but I think in this instance, it's actually safer than using an S10 wallet for a large amount of crypto.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like you mentioned, there's a lot of wallet options out there that you can obviously install on Android and iOS devices. But, you know, let's be real, we're pretty big geeks. We use, probably a lot of us listening to this and myself included, use a lot of third-party apps. But the reality is most people buying Galaxies or iPhones are going to use the native apps. That's just the nature of the business. So, you know, people are going to be driven to use this wallet, and hopefully it's a good user experience.
Yeah, exactly. I think from the videos that I saw, whether real or fake, it did look quite nice, quite Samsung-y, if that's a term. But yeah, it'll be cool to see how this evolves. And I'm curious to see people play around with it once the phone's actually released. So that was all the news for the week that I wanted to talk about. There wasn't actually that much that happened unless I missed things, but I don't think I did. So there's a few project updates that I wanted to walk through. The first was MyEther Wallet. They launched an exit to fiat gateway. So they're doing this through a service called Bitty. And the noteworthy thing about this is it's KYC-less, so you don't actually need to identify yourself, but it is limited to Swiss francs and I think the euro, so it's limited to a certain jurisdiction. But it's basically compliant with the Swiss laundering anti-money laundering ordinance. So the AMLA, some regulatory body or regulation in Switzerland. I'm not sure on the details, but it was very interesting to see Myth Wallet enable this, because KYC has been it goes against the crypto ethos at the end of the day. Like, we're all about privacy and you know, keeping your data secure and with you. KYC goes against that. You have to upload your identity documents to like exchanges, and if the exchange gets hacked, that could get stolen. We've seen it a lot with ICOs. So ICOs required you to upload your KYC documents, and a lot of these ICOs were so dodgy. But during 2017, people just gave away their information because they wanted to get in. And as we saw, these ICOs got hacked. Not the ICO, the companies running them got hacked, or it got leaked, or they onsold that information because their ICO wasn't successful and they had all these data and they thought, oh, let's sell it. I know that since 2017, I participated in a couple of ICOs with my real mobile number. Stupid mistake on my part, but I've definitely noticed an uptick in spam calls. So I wouldn't put it past them to be selling the data there. But back to the Exeter Fiat Gateway. I just thought it was great to see it being KYC-less to avoid all these pitfalls, basically.
Yeah, definitely. I guess I'll add on top of this, as a part of this kind of exit to fiat, this came as a part of design overall for my Ether wallet. Definitely always been kind of a staple tool in the community. I've used it a lot, and their new design looks really cool. And, you know, one of those aspects is obviously this exit to fiat. Sounds like, on the US side, this is not an option right now. I'm not really going to hold my breath for that to be an option in the near future. I'm pretty sure we'll probably be the last ones there, maybe right ahead of Iran or something like that. As far as our regulations go, they're very strict when it comes to this stuff, but it's good to see. I mean, definitely still kind of the Achilles heel when it comes to crypto are fiat on and off ramps. And I know a lot of people want to go about this with no KYC, as you said, but the reality of the situation is in a lot of countries right now that KYC needs to be there. Hopefully we just kind of see more and more of these options pop up. I mean, it's always good to just have different options out there, right? So if you're someone that lives in Europe or Switzerland or wherever it might be for these options, you can get on and off. And if you don't want to do that, you don't have to use KYC. I mean, just the seamlessness of that is huge. I'm getting pretty bullish on some options I'm seeing pop up as far as USD to DAI options, like SendWire and all these things. I think that's really going to open the next kind of possibilities when it comes to crypto adoption, when you can really seamlessly get on and off from fiat to crypto.
It's interesting that you mentioned DAI, because DAI, as we know, is pegged to the US dollar, so you don't need KYC to buy DAI, basically, depending on which exchange you buy it on, I guess. There is a bit of a roundabout way of doing it. As long as you get ETH from somewhere or some other token that you can trade for DAI and then trade it on maybe a decentralized exchange that doesn't require KYC, you can basically get access to US dollars, which is really, really cool. But obviously, DAI is not accepted anywhere near as much as the US dollar is accepted. It's only accepted for a few crypto-related things, maybe a couple of stores. I don't know for sure, but it's definitely an interesting thing. As we see DAI adoption increase, will we see these fiat gateways turn into DAI gateways maybe, and people don't want to go to fiat because they prefer to go to DAI, and it's just easier. As you said, the US is probably never going to do or be one of the last ones to do KYC-less exit to fiat. And that's understandable from a regulation standpoint. But if we can do exit to DAI instead, it's equivalent in that the value is the same, as long as DAI doesn't break its peg, of course. But it's the adoption of where DAI is accepted is definitely what's going to keep people from obviously going to DAI instead of actual US dollars. But it'll change in time. I do believe it'll change in time, especially with how fast MakerDAO and DAI are growing. So the next thing I wanted to talk about was the Ethereum grants wave number 5 was announced this week. So this is a funny one. There were a few comments about this one publicly on Twitter. I think you jumped in, Eric. I think it was you. Might have been someone else. But basically, 7 new projects were funded during this grant wave, but the funding amounts weren't listed. So this is a very weird thing, because as we've seen over the past few weeks, or few months, I guess, people have been crying out for more transparency from the Ethereum Foundation. And this is kind of going in the opposite direction now that they're just getting rid of the amounts that have been funded for these teams. It's just basically a list of teams, what they're building, and you know that they've been given a grant, but it doesn't actually say how much it is. So it's really weird that the Ethereum Foundation has done this. I'm sure they have their reasons. But yeah, I thought it was went against everything that the community was crying out for. Again, they can do what they want. It's their foundation. But I think that in the interest of the community, then they really do need to be more transparent about these things. People are questioning this all the time. We're at Ether, we're trying to write pages to bring more transparency to certain things about Ethereum in general, and especially the EF. So yeah, I mean, I'll let you speak a bit more about it, Eric, because I know you had a few interesting thoughts about this one.
Yeah, this one's tough for me. Like, I do think the grants program is doing a lot of good, and we're seeing a lot of projects come out of it quickly, which is great to see. We talk a lot about that in previous episodes. So, you know, I don't want to say anything bad about the grants program. Where I do have a gripe here is, like you said, I mean, we've been harping for more transparency from the EF for years now. I mean, Ethereum.org hasn't been updated forever. There's no pages out there of members of the foundation. There's no pages out there for what the foundation thinks they're responsible for. It's just kind of a mess. So it's really weird to me that it wouldn't at least be some give and take here. You know, on the surface, is not showing the grant amounts the worst thing in the world? No, probably not. Like, we're all going to live without seeing that. And there are some reasons why you would want to hide them so that people can't kind of measure their grant versus others and things like that. But, you know, you would hope that in doing this, they would have at least kind of given something else. Like, hey, here's a transparency page on the foundation itself and what we've been working on. Hey, by the way, we hid the grant amounts. And I know the EF isn't one kind of one monolithic organization. There's a lot of teams inside there working on different things. But, you know, you would kind of hope there would be a little bit of coordination when it came to this. So it just kind of left a bad taste in people's mouth when we've been harping on this, that this was kind of the first to go backwards wasn't the right move. That being said, you know, I fully agree with you. I think it's at ETHUB, one of our things is asking for transparency and creating pages that help people understand what's going on in the Ethereum ecosystem. And part of that is absolutely around the Ethereum Foundation. And I've seen a lot of confusion around kind of the core devs and what they are and what they're supposed to do. A lot of people don't understand that the core devs aren't like a team that's underneath the Ethereum Foundation. Sure, there's some connections between some of the devs and the EF, but you know, I think I've realized and we've realized at ETHUB on our team that we need to maybe just provide these pages. A lot of people are complaining that the Ethereum.org website hasn't been updated forever and that we're kind of missing some important information. And I think internally we've decided to take this upon ourselves to put some information out there and also put out a page that we think should kind of be a landing page for people that are asking about Ethereum and what it is. So I think people are going to see some exciting stuff come from our team in March or so.
Yeah, that's some of the stuff I was talking about at the start, about how our March updates to ETHUB is going to be quite big. That's definitely something we're working on with the Ethereum transparency across the board, not just with the Ethereum Foundation, but everything. Everything that we see on Twitter, constant questions. We basically look at Twitter and we see what the most popular or repeated questions are for ETHUB, and then we just go and write a page for it or ask around and you know, and see who's got the information for us to make public, as long as it's supposed to be made public. There are things obviously that don't want to be kept private, not because they're trying to hide anything, but just because it's sensitive information that isn't meant to be public in the first place. But anything that we believe that is meant to be public, but it's just not formalized, and it's just like maybe on GitHub or in ETH research posts or, you know, on someone's blog or something that actually is public, but just hasn't been, you know, formalized and there's not a central place for it. That's what we're basically doing at ETHUB. So yeah, look for those in March, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. And just a note there, it's not like we're like, oh, they can't do it, so we're going to do it. It's more realizing that, you know, they're probably strained for time and it's just not at the top of their priority list right now. And this is something we think ETHUB could fit. And it's more like, hey, why don't we just do this for you and kind of make it a community effort and just kind of spur new activity and kind of get the ball rolling here.
Yeah, exactly. The EF is definitely focused on getting ETH 2.0 rolled out. That's definitely should be their focus, their number one focus, in my opinion. So we're glad to pick up the I wouldn't call it slack, but pick up where they kind of left off. I think it being a community-driven thing is a lot more important than it being from a central body. Obviously, ETHUB is completely open source and anyone can go onto our GitHub and you know, submit any content. So I think that's definitely the better model and why we went with that instead of relying on a central party to get this information out there, basically. So on that note, I wanted to move on to one last thing I wanted to talk about with project updates this week. You can now invest in property using DAI. So this was really random and cool to see on Twitter. So you can invest in a Brooklyn-based property using DAI, basically. And as I was saying before, DAI is not accepted everywhere, but it is accepted for a few niche things. And you know, this is one of the big things that is accepted for outside of kind of a crypto native thing. So obviously we see it integrated, see DAI integrated with all the crypto apps like the decentralized exchanges or Gitcoin grants or, you know, Dharma or things like that. So it's really cool to see that it's kind of being bridged into the real world and someone's accepting it as if it was US dollars. So I'm expecting to see more of this pop up. I'm not, see, then this, and it does beg the question as to why someone would accept DAI instead of US dollars when they're kind of the same thing in terms of their value. But maybe these people are crypto natives, for example, and they want to use their DAI inside of crypto. Or I think there might be some tax implications for it as well. I'm not sure. Like, there's probably a few different reasons, about this. I'm not, you know, an expert on US law, US tax law, or anything like that, or regulations in there. So maybe you've got a bit more ideas around why someone would want to accept DAI instead of US dollars for a property, Eric.
Yeah, I guess my hunches off the bat would be that they're just kind of at least opening themselves up to a larger community. So I guess if you're looking to get a very large commercial loan, a structured loan, which is the case here, I mean, you probably, for larger buildings, you can't just like walk into a bank branch, right, and be like, hey, I need a very large loan to build a building in New York. If you've got a very good reputation and credit, you might be able to do that. But the odds are you're going to kind of probably raise these funds from a bunch of different investors. And you know, this product is kind of that. And it looks like they're opening up some of the tranches or some of the investment to crypto holders, I guess, right? DAI. It looks like it's probably a bit risky. I think the returns were like, I might be misquoting this. I thought they were like 15% or something like that. So there's probably definitely some risk involved in a loan like this that the building, you know, doesn't take off or defaults or whatever it might be. But I guess my hunch would be, yeah, you're kind of opening up to this crypto space, which is looking to do something with their crypto, looking to invest their crypto. If you kind of just go to US dollar, right, you're kind of closing off the market a bit. And what you said earlier in the podcast is interesting. Maybe regulators are starting to look at DAI like they are USD, kind of just a tokenized USD, which it theoretically is. I mean, it's not like, deep down it's not, but on the surface, I guess it is. So maybe the tax implications there and like the regulations around, hey, we're going to accept this token that's pegged to the dollar versus, hey, we're going to accept like Ether or Bitcoin, where you might have some more kind of eyebrows raised when it comes to regulations or taxes or whatever it might be. That might be one of the reasons they're going the DAI route.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned it might just open up a bigger pool of investors. It definitely would, I would think, because I mean, DAI isn't extremely liquid at the moment. It's actually quite, I wouldn't call it illiquid, but it's not very, it's no Tether, for example, but it obviously is completely different. But maybe someone has a lot of ETH that they would rather not cash out to US dollars and would rather cash out to DAI. It becomes a kind of, it's weird because if they have ETH that they've been able to keep in a wallet that they know hasn't been traced to them, they could trade that ETH on a decentralized exchange for DAI. If they practice proper operational security, they would be able to hide themselves quite nicely from, you know, most prying eyes, I guess. Maybe not from people doing deep investigations into you, but that's, you know, that hardly happens, you're not, you know, in these sorts of things. But yeah, so it'd be interesting to see if they're cashing out to DAI and then wanting to use that DAI for something. So if they were to invest in this property, would a regulator ask, hey, where did you get this DAI from? You know what I mean? Maybe that opens them up to scrutiny altogether. So it's a rabbit hole at the end of the day, I think, because regulators have not, at least in the US, have not given any kind of clarity at a federal level from what I've been reading. I'm not a US native. I don't know all the laws and regulations there, but on the surface, from what I read online and things like that, it just seems to be that the regulators have just given zero to little guidance on a lot of these things, especially DAI. Like, as you were saying, DAI is USD on the surface, but not USD when you dig really deep into it. It's just a representation of it. It's not actually US dollars, and the peg can obviously break, and there obviously is points of failure of the maker system that people, you know, obviously are aware of, such as the price oracles not being totally decentralized and things like that. And, you know, there was a post a few weeks ago about how DAI might not be as scalable as other stablecoins, which might make it risky and its peg might break. there's all these sorts of things. And, you know, this is like a rabbit hole for regulators, right? I'm not sure how they would tackle this sort of stuff, let alone tackle someone trading their ETH for DAI and then using that DAI to invest in a, you know, a real world property to maybe hide their money. I don't know. It's so crazy, especially because we don't even have privacy on layer one. I don't know how they would do that in a private way, trying to hide their tracks. But yeah, I mean, I got off on a little bit of a tangent there, but things to think about, of course. So yeah, that was really cool to see. Cool. So a couple of on-chain activity bits I wanted to talk about this week. A funny auger market. I'll let you talk to this one, Eric. An auger market that thinks Constantinople upgrade will fail. I think it was at like, it was swinging between 5% success to like 30% success. It wasn't extremely liquid, the market itself, but you had obviously a good theory as to why this market was, why people were voting no on this market. I'd let you run us through it, Eric.
Yeah, so basically this market was, will Constantinople be successful by February 28th? Now, I wanted to say, anybody that's interested in Augur or wants to try Augur, or I guess any prediction markets that are out there, but Augur's kind of the only one that are live right now, although Gnosis is kind of starting to be built on top of, but always be careful of the wording of the market. So we kind of saw this with the famous U.S. election midterm market that said, will the Democrats control the House, by at the end of the midterms or whatever it was. I can't remember the exact language, but there were some discrepancies over, wait, did it mean like they would actually control it that day or would they win it? So this market had that same problem. It said, would Constantinople be successful by February 28th? Now, if you actually read the fine print of the market, it says by February 28th at 00000 UTC time. So basically, you know, the first minute of February 28th and right after February 27th ends. Now, if you actually do the math on Constantinople and the block times, and people have been able to do this for a while now. I think I tweeted something out 10 or 14 days ago saying that this will happen around midday, February 28th Pacific time. So that's definitely going to be after this auger market specifies. So this is kind of key. Like, make sure you read the fine print on these auger markets. Of course, everyone's like, oh yeah, it's going to happen February 28th. And you know, people are definitely buying up the yes side of this. Now, one gripe I kind of have to pick here is Vail, which is supposed to be kind of, you know, curating auger markets and just kind of putting the best ones at the forefront, actually had this one out there for trading. And they actually were tweeting saying, hey, check out this market, and basically hinting that it was a good deal. So it's kind of amazing to me that, you know, I really like Vail and what they're doing, but it's kind of amazing to me that people that are even curating these markets are missing kind of the fine print details underneath them. So definitely tread with caution when you're betting on auger markets. And I personally don't even participate in ones that I think have some ambiguity or might even be kind of voted invalid because it's just a waste of time and money.
Yeah, I'm on Vail right now looking at the market. It actually is a user nominated market, apparently. And it's currently 6% yes vote. So it's really funny to see how it actually spiked up to, I think, 50% on the 25th. And since then, it's kind of crashed back down to 6%. So it's a very interesting market to follow. As you said, the devil is in the details. So the title of the market is what you said it was. And then you go into the details and you can see the actual timestamp. So on the title, it just says by February 28th, 2019. Scroll down to the details. You see 2019-02-28-T-00000. So definitely everyone betting on any markets, make sure that the wording's correct and you understand the details, not just the title of the market, but look at the details as well. I do agree with you. Vail should have maybe not tweeted this out in the way that they did. I didn't see the tweet, but if they did tweet this out, with that was a little bit misleading. Unfortunately, these things happen. Sometimes the fine print isn't read. We all know about that. We all read the terms and conditions, right? But yeah, so yeah, I mean, I encourage people to go on that to Vail and look at this as well, and you can see for yourself. It's really funny to see.
Yeah, I mean, I think this definitely highlights a bit of a problem with Augur, and I suppose maybe prediction markets as in general as they grow. There's definitely some problems with how you word markets. There's no kind of curations of market before they go to market, if that makes sense. So there's not really like a voting process of, hey, yeah, you know, this market's very clear and this makes sense and this is not misleading to future bettors. That process doesn't really take place until the market goes live. You know, eventually a market can be deemed invalid, but, you know, I've seen a little Twitter conversation between Joey Krug, who's the founder of Augur, and, you know, I think Vitalik got in on some of the conversations in the past whenever the midterm market was happening. But it'd be nice to find some kind of mechanism that makes it possible for this. You know, I've theorized myself. I don't think I've really come up with much, but, you know, potentially maybe like the founder of the market has to put some kind of stake behind it to, you know, kind of say that it's not misleading. Maybe, I guess, just in general, there's got to be some way to find some financial incentive, kind of staking for a creator of a market to not be intentionally misleading. I mean, maybe this person that created this market and thinking about it wasn't really trying to be misleading and people just don't read the details. But in general, for this stuff to go mainstream, I think that's kind of got to be out of the picture.
Yeah, definitely. A long time to go before this sort of stuff's mainstream, I think. And that, you know, people harp on about how Augur doesn't really, you know, has a lot of active users or whatever. Obviously, we fight a lot of those trolls on Twitter. But definitely, even with these new UI, UXs and things, I think the next kind of forefront for crypto adoption is education. We can't have people adopting these things if they have no idea what they are. Like before I heard about Augur, I had no idea what a prediction market was. And I only know about it because I went digging into the weeds. I'm not even sure if we have a proper EthHub page for Augur yet. But these sorts of things are just, the education for it is quite sparse. I know that Coinbase is doing, you know, their Coinbase Earn program with tokens that they list, such as 0x and Zcash, I think, so far, which is really cool. I think that's a really good way to do it. Incentivize people to learn about the tokens by giving them money. I can't think of a better incentive than that. Even though the money might be not much, it's still something and people will still do it, I think, if money's involved. And it's just cool to learn about too. Like Coinbase has a, you know, nice graphics on there, simple explanations. It doesn't present the ideas in a complicated way. So yeah, definitely education is next. And that's what we're focusing on with EthHub as well. And that's one of the reasons we started EthHub, because we thought all this stuff was very confusing, especially ETH 2.0. It was just incredibly confusing because there wasn't anything, you know, in English language, basically. It was a lot of science and math terminology and a lot of complicated stuff that you needed prior knowledge for. So yeah, definitely interesting to see if the education, if more people come out with education like Coinbase or similar services to EthHub and things like that.
Yeah, I think for there, like user experience is going to play a huge role, right? So like Vail and Guesser kind of put very simple UIs. I mean, Guesser, it just has like a couple buttons. I used it a few weeks back around the Super Bowl. But, you know, UX is going to make it, to me, like what the mainstream is going to end up wanting to use prediction markets mostly for is probably going to be around like sports betting or like betting on the Oscars, things like that, the elections. So just kind of like making people not even aware what they're betting on, but just proving the efficiency through costs and things like that, which a lot of kind of online or in-person casinos take. That's where, you know, I definitely agree with you. We got to like kind of educate what's actually going on, but you could almost hide 90% of the stuff that users don't need. But, you know, of course, in doing that, we got to make sure that these curators aren't presenting kind of invalid or misleading markets to people.
Yeah, the most important part, as you mentioned, is the curation of these markets. Because even with sports betting, obviously at the moment, they're pretty much completely centralized. So the company just puts up the bets themselves and, you know, it's all above board and everything above board. but yeah, you know, you get what I'm saying? Like not anyone can submit a market on these centralized entities. Whereas on Augur, anyone can submit a market and anyone can pick it up. And as we saw with the midterms, it becomes a mess, but that's what the Augur reputation token is for. Of course, for these kind of dispute rounds and to work out the final result of this market, regardless of the wording. So the next thing I wanted to talk about was I noticed a few big Maker CDPs minting lots of DAI, but not trading it. There was a huge one, 3088, who is the third largest CDP by collateral. They took out 3 million DAI in the same day, and it's still sitting in their account. I'm looking at it right now. 3 million DAI sitting in their Ethereum wallet. Now, this wouldn't be weird to me if there we had the DAI savings rate, which is basically a way to earn continuous interest on your DAI, even if you're just holding it and doing nothing with it. So I think the number was thrown around about 2%. So, you know, if you were to take out 3 million DAI and just hold on to it, you'd earn 2% a year on it. And then you obviously balance that with the stability fee or the fee that you have for on your CDP as well. But yeah, that isn't live yet. And yeah, these DAIs are sitting in the account. And as we saw this week, there was a lot of price movement in ETH especially, where it went up to, it was 160 something, and now it's back down to about 140. And I thought that this person was withdrawing all these DAI to basically buy more ETH and put ETH back into their CDP, which is what they've historically done, you know, since I've been watching them. It's just a lot of draw DAI, buy ETH, lock the ETH in their CDP, you know, repeat basically. But they didn't do it this time. So I'm curious to see what they do with this DAI. I don't know if you've looked at this, if you had any, you know, theories about this, but I think they're just waiting basically.
Yeah, I'm not sure. This one has me stumped, to be honest. I've seen them. You're kind of just like waiting for it to move finally and do something. Like, why just sit there and pay the fee? I mean, I guess it's still on a yearly basis pretty low, although it just got raised to 1.5. I mean, maybe they're, I guess it could hit the cap at a point. I'm actually not sure how far we are from the cap right now. You might know, but potentially they're wanting to mint this before kind of the cap is hit. And potentially they have plans with it in the next couple of weeks or months, and they just want to be able to make that move. But to be honest with you, I'm not really sure. It'll be interesting to keep an eye on this.
Actually, it's interesting you mentioned the cap. I didn't even think of that. The cap, I think it's, the cap's currently 100 million DAI. We're at 88 million DAI. So that actually might be what they're doing, withdrawing it before the cap's hit, because we don't actually have an indication of when or what the cap is going to be raised to. I think obviously if the cap gets reached, Maker token holders will want the cap to be raised. But at the same time, we've seen a few balancing acts happening. So, you know, the stability fee was changed again this week for Maker. It was increased because people were minting enough DAI, and we've almost reached the cap. So it actually did what it was supposed to do. So it's going to be interesting to see how fast we reach that 100 million DAI and then what happens after that. If it gets, you know, raised again, or if the ceiling is just kept at 100 million for a little bit. So enough on the on-chain activity. There's one tweet that I wanted to talk about this week. So this is, I guess, about, you know, what we've been talking about the last few weeks. Last week, we spoke about the Afri kind of drama and what happened in the community. And, you know, that's all kind of settled now, I think, in terms of the drama. But there's obviously a lot of stuff happening in the background. The TLDR is that Afri has unfortunately left the Ethereum project due to, you know, a few, I wouldn't call it a lot of the community. I call it a few people, especially on Reddit. They were being incredibly toxic, coming up with conspiracy theories about how Afri's trying to sabotage Ethereum because of Polkadot, because Afri works for Parity, who is developing Polkadot, which many consider to be an Ethereum competitor. So Afri basically said, yeah, that's it, I'm out, because he wasn't actually being paid for a lot of the work he was doing for Ethereum. Even though he works for Parity, he wasn't getting paid to be the hard fork coordinator, which is a very important job, and he was doing that for free. He launched the Gauli testnet. He, you know, did a lot of stuff on GitHub for Ethereum. So, but basically this spurred a lot of conversation, and there was one tweet that put out by Cyrus Unisi about how, you know, different communities scale in different ways. So he doesn't believe that Reddit scales very well at all, and I'm inclined to agree with him. Like, it's very hard to scale Reddit simply because people are anonymous a lot of the time on Reddit, so their usernames aren't tied to any real identity. Reddit doesn't actually collect much information about you once you set up an account, or I'm not sure about it anymore, but, you know, for a long time they didn't. Basically, you just put in your, you know, email address and your username, whatever. You didn't have to put in your age or anything, and that was it. So you could be anonymous on there. There's a lot of voting manipulation that goes on. It's very easy to manipulate votes on Reddit, especially on the smaller subreddit. So if you're on a token subreddit or something, you know, it's very easy for there to be bullish posts on there because some people want to pump the price of something. It's crazy. We saw a lot of this in 2017 on Reddit, especially the R cryptocurrency subreddit. That was, I believe, heavily manipulated during 2017 simply because there were coins that came out of nowhere that I had never heard of before, and they were like the flavor of the week for the cryptocurrency sub. And, you know, anyone who kind of talked, you know, against it or said that, hey, this is, you know, this is crap, why are you promoting this, was instantly downvoted. So it's definitely a lot of botting going on and things like that. So yeah, Reddit, I think, is a very, once it grows, you know, once the subreddit grows too big, it becomes a very noisy and bad platform. But then Cyrus goes on to say that Twitter is a lot better. And I agree with him on this. Twitter is much better for, you know, the opposite reasons. A lot of people use their real identity. It's very easy to just block or mute someone on Twitter if they're being excessively annoying. Like, we all know about Decentrali and a couple of his other accounts that, you know, literally call everything a scam. I tend to block those accounts straight away, because as soon as I post anything about Ethereum, he comes in and says, Ethereum's a centralized scam, blah, 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 and links to the Ethereum fraud subreddit, which is, you know, just the whole thing. Yeah, I definitely agree with Cyrus here. And he also asked more questions like, how do we scale as a community as Ethereum continues to grow? So I know you've had a few thoughts about this, Eric. You know, did you want to touch on this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess I could talk about this topic for a while. And I got kind of started in crypto back in the day in these social spaces. So, you know, initially when I first discovered it was around Reddit, moved into some IRC channels, believe it or not, for some trading in Bitcoin back in the day. And then, you know, kind of got initially introduced to a lot of the community members on Reddit, the Ethereum and ETHTrader Reddit back in the day. I moved off of Reddit pretty much, I would say, in the last year and a half, year to 2 years, I guess, because of these issues we're talking about, and kind of have kind of moved solely to, well, initially I moved kind of to chat channels, and then have moved to Twitter. I personally think Twitter is the best place to discuss crypto. I mean, I've only been on it discussing crypto for like 9 months now, and I've really enjoyed it, mainly for the reasons you said. Like, I enjoy that a lot of people have a face tied to a name. I think that goes a long way. A lot of reputable people in the community are on there. You know, even anon accounts, that's fine if you don't want to have a picture and a kind of a name out there, as long as you're respectable and putting out, you know, you're not attacking people and don't deserve a block and stuff like that. I even see people like that go really far away on there. Yeah, Reddit, I guess my problem here is like the whole Offrey drama. People blame the quote unquote Ethereum community for like a couple trolls on Reddit. And I think that's just downright ridiculous. I think to lump people into, you know, a couple people on a very gameable website, like, you just go Google buy Reddit votes right now. It's like the easiest thing you could possibly do. It basically costs no money. And you can get hundreds, thousands of upvotes if you want it. And, you know, I know there's a lot of kind of different sects of the internet out there that have different groups. And if you were a coin, maybe trying to want to socially attack Ethereum, you know, you don't even need to go buy upvotes. You kind of have a community of your own that people can go out and upvote and downvote certain things. So I think to overreact to stuff that happened on Reddit is frankly kind of ridiculous. I didn't really see, you know, any respectable person in the community, any known figure like attacking Offrey in this case. So I think to kind of use Reddit example is just wrong. And, you know, going back to the question though of how do we scale the community? I mean, it's tough. Like, I think Twitter has done a good job. Like, most people are on there, or most people that want to have a voice in the community are on there. But kind of one of the bigger problems, there's so many of these different like chat apps and online chats. Like, you got like the core devs Gitter, and then you've got a lot of Telegram and Discord channels, and people are talking about ETH 2.0 here and there and on their Teams channel. And like, just, it's very spread out. I think we do need to find a way to kind of bring all of this together. And to be honest, kind of one of our longer term goals of ETH Hub is for ETH Hub to truly become like a hub for Ethereum, right? Like, we're not going to stop at just documentation. We want to make sure that this is a place that people can go and stay up to date on the latest information. And hopefully we can kind of find a way to collate all of this information that's so spread across the internet to kind of help towards this social scalability goal.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the different chat apps that we're seeing people use, especially, you know, Telegram and WhatsApp and Discord and all these sorts of things. I think a lot of the core community members or people who've been around for a while are like you and me, that we've just gone off Reddit and we've gone to Twitter as our public face, and then we've retreated into private channels to have the more serious discussions, because there's just so many trolls. Like, we troll as well on Twitter a bit, but we poke fun at XRP, we call out Bitcoiners, but that's all in, you know, all in good fun. The actual trolls who just keep spitting misinformation constantly on these platforms is just, it causes people to retreat and to go off these platforms, and we lose a lot of the good conversations that we have. And I hope this doesn't happen with Twitter, because Twitter is just awesome. And I think Twitter is very intelligent in how it is kind of, I think I saw someone mention it on Twitter actually, that it's a thin protocol. It doesn't do much, but what it does, it does very, very well. And that's kind of be a micro blogging platform where people can just, you know, stream their thoughts out there and talk about different things and reply to people, and people do tweet threads now and all that sort of stuff. And then obviously it's more merit-based as well. So you build up your own reputation on there. I know a few people in the, you know, a few good people, good friends that I talk to online, they built up their reputations, especially, you know, you, Eric, you only got onto the scene last year. There's a few like Chaz, who helps us with ETHUB, he also puts out a lot of good stuff. There's too many people to name. I tweeted about people that you should follow over the last few days. So if people want to find good people to follow, just go through my Twitter feed and you'll be able to see that on there. But yeah, so I think Twitter does that very well, and it allows people to build up their own strong reputations with a name attached to their face. But as you said, people can also be anonymous. One person that I want to give a shout out to is Antiprosynthesis, probably the most popular anonymous Ethereum person that I know on Twitter. He is fighting people all day in a good way. He's fighting misinformation all the time, and no one knows who he is. Like, I don't even know who he is, basically, you know, in real life. So it's really cool to see that someone can build up their reputation without having to tie their real name to it, basically.
Yeah, definitely. It's just a good platform to help, like, people reach out, hey, is this true? Is this not true? It's a good, I mean, there's definitely still misinformation spread on Twitter, but it's a lot harder to do because of the way the conversations happen. And you can quote people and, you know, just call them out if you need to or whatever it might be. And so you can kind of get to the bottom of the truth pretty quick, which is nice. On Reddit, you know, people look at upvotes. It's very gameable. Like, and the conversation could get hidden with downvotes. It's just very, I hope, you know, I do love the Ethereum Reddit, the ETH Trader Reddit. There's a ton of good people on there. There's a lot of good content. I don't want us to, I mean, it's unfortunate in the Ofri situation that people put too much weight into what happened there, because I don't think people realize the gaming that's occurring, and especially in the cryptocurrency space when there's financial incentives to kind of attack other communities.
Yeah, exactly. So it'll be very interesting to see if Reddit sees more of a kind of exodus, or if it's just, you know, the bear market that's got it down. Because I did notice that on Reddit, a lot of the engagement has gone down. But I think that's because of the bear market as well. So We'll see what happens. I fully expect during another bull market for all these platforms to explode. So I'm interested to see how they scale. Or, you know, I hope Ethereum doesn't lose its identity. Like, you know, if it gets too big for its own good, and, you know, there's too much warring going on. We've seen it happen with Bitcoin. It got way too big. And there's a lot of communities, especially, you know, we saw the Bitcoin Cash fight, and then Bitcoin Cash SV, and or Bitcoin SV or whatever it's called, and, you know, all these different Bitcoin forks, all these different communities. It's kind of, it reminded me of a religion where there was this one religion, and then, you know, all these different kind of groups split off and created their own variations of that religion. You know, and the white papers, the holy book or whatever it is. So it's really funny when you compare it to those sorts of things, and the communities kind of blur the lines there as well in how they act, and, you know, how they evangelize things and preach things, if you will, things like that as well. So there's one last thing that we wanted to cover in the podcast today. I think it was a new section, Eric, that you suggested we should do. It's kind of a eating our own dog food kind of section, where we go through an Ethereum dApp that we've played with during the week, and, you know, we explain what we liked about it, what we didn't like about it, you know, what could be better. And I know that you, Eric, you were playing with Raiden, the Raiden network this week, setting up a node with that. So did you want to walk us through what you did and your experience with it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's kind of important to talk about trying to use, you know, things that are being built out there. And there's a lot of stuff in alpha and beta. So, of course, there's some growing pains along the way. But I wanted to talk about Raiden. Of course, Raiden's been around. The concept's been around for years now. You know, it's nothing new to crypto in general to have a payment channel. But Raiden's kind of been building out their technology for a while. I saw that they put out an update the other day. And what attracted me is they put some updates to their user interface, which, of course, to me, you know, I can be fairly technical. I'm not a developer by any means. I can work my way around a command line, but I prefer not to. So I decided to give it a try. And actually, to my surprise, the kind of install process, they've been putting a lot of cautions out there. You know, it's alpha and it might be rocky. The process was actually smoother than I thought. I do already run a full node. So that made it easy because I was able to just hook into that and kind of create a new wallet to hold my state channel pledge funds. But basically, I just downloaded something, extracted the you know, the EXE, and pointed to it in my command line, pointed that to my node, and it just fired up. And what was nice is there's a nice user interface. I will say, you know, if I had to point some stuff out, and I'm sure they're aware, the user interface is pretty crude. It doesn't really kind of guide the user through what they're doing. But I would say in about, 30 to 45 minutes time. And part of that was getting my node up to sync for a day I was missing. I had created two state channels, which was pretty cool. I created one on my own and I realized I should have, you basically create one, tag your address, and then you connect to another node to create, open the channel. I connected my first one to some random channel. I looked at the map and I was like, well, I'm not actually really contributing to the hub here. So then I opened a second and I actually connected to somebody that was connected to another that kind of had created a cluster of channels. I think I was like the 53rd and 54th channel to open or something like that. And they have a limit on how much ETH you can stake in a channel right now. It's like 0.075 ETH, I think you can put in per channel just because it's an alpha. You know, definitely some growing pains. I complain a lot of, you know, I wish that command line, like most users aren't going to understand probably even what I did, even though there's a user interface at the end. And I know it's early. Hopefully they kind of come out with a couple, you know, one or two click installs, but I'm sure that's going to take some time. And they're more worried about actually building out the protocol at this point. But, you know, I still have my channels running, they're hooked into my node. So I definitely suggest people go out there and give it a try and, you know, open up some channels. And what this enables is just instant and feeless peer-to-peer payments of ERC-20 tokens.
Yeah, it's really cool to see, you playing with Raiden. I haven't had a chance to yet, but I hope to in the next few days when I get some time. And for those that don't know, Raiden is basically the Lightning Network on Ethereum. Obviously, it's different in its implementation, but it's at a high level, it's the same thing where, you know, as you mentioned, Eric, instant feeless or low fee payments within the Raiden network itself. And they do have a token that was, you know, quite controversial at the time, but the token isn't actually required to use the payment channels. I can't remember what the token was, was used for. Do you remember, Eric?
Yeah, so it's for their micro Raiden, which to be honest, I was trying to reread it the other day and I didn't have to use the token to do what I did. It seems something like if you don't want to use a full node, like you can pay using this token. To be honest, I'm going to butcher this, but I guess the moral of the story is to kind of use the base protocol, which is out there and what I was using. The token wasn't required.
Yeah, that's really good to hear. We see this a lot with projects using tokens or issuing tokens that might not be needed, to put it lightly. So it'll be interesting to see how Raiden grows and what the token is used for in the future, basically. So thank you, Eric, for walking us through that. We'll work on improving that section. It's kind of a new section. We're not sure where to put it in the podcast. We left it to the end because we just wanted to experiment with it, but we might move it up to after the kind of project update section, depending on what kind of feedback we get. So definitely give us feedback if you want to hear more about the dApps that we've been using day to day, basically. Cool. So that's it for the podcast for this week. Thank you everyone again for listening. If you haven't subscribed yet to the ETHUB weekly newsletter, go to ethub.substack.com and definitely go to podcast.ethub.io to subscribe to the podcast that you're listening to right now if you haven't already. So see you next week, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast. You can subscribe to us at podcast.ethub.io, as well as follow us on Twitter at econoar and at zazzle0x.